Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. This week, we're donning the uniform and heading over to New Scotland Yard to chat to Ian Donnelly, a recently retired policeman with more than 30 years' experience under his belt. During his time in the Met, he's seen the force go from bad to worse. But what's behind this drastic dip in fortunes for policing? It's just one of many questions he addresses in his new book, Tango Juliet Foxtrot, which he's here to talk to us about. Welcome.
So, Ian Donnelly, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Thank you very much, Vicky. It's really nice to be chatting to you this afternoon.
This rainy Friday afternoon. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to chat to me. We're here to talk about your book, your new book, Tango Juliet Foxtrot, which is, will be out by the time this podcast comes out. And so for those not familiar with police lingo, could we maybe start off with you explaining the title?
Yeah, by all means. Just check. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast? Okay, only that will become obvious when I explain what Tiger Juliet or TJF, what TJF actually means. So when I joined the police back in 1989, one of the first things I was told, or one of the things I kind of overheard people saying to each other, which didn't really make any sense to me at all when I heard it, was people would say TJF to each other. And I was like, I remember saying to someone, what TJF mean? And they said, well, it means that the job's fucked, in a fairly derisory way, in response to something kind of pointless or stupid that someone was told to do generally by a senior officer, or be in response to some new policy that had come in, which basically made the job kind of harder than it needed to be. So I named the book Tango Juliet Foxtrot. And I suppose the reason I did that was because I wanted to explore in the book whether the police service in Britain is actually fucked now, or whether that is just still something that people have always said, or police officers have always said.
So what kind of spurred you to initially start writing the book then? Like, is it different to how you imagined it would be when you started writing it?
Yeah, it was a very kind of organic thing, I think. I had no intention of writing a book. So I retired as a superintendent, which I suppose for those listening who don't really understand police ranks is, I suppose, fairly senior, but not super senior. So I was kind of probably senior management. But I'd started, like everybody did, as a uniformed PC in South London back in 1989. So I retired after my 30 years contracted service in 2019. When you leave the police after 30 years, there's lots of things that you kind of want to do, things that you're promising yourself. And I've got two older kids in there. I've got two young ones, and I've got two older kids in their 20s. And I'd said to them, let's go and do a bit of traveling in various countries in Central Europe. And I started writing there, actually. I wanted it to be something that I could sort of put in a brown envelope and put in a safe or whatever and say, on the event of my death, you can read this, because it will kind of explain my life a little bit more, what I did, why probably I wasn't around as much as I would have liked to have been, because as I started writing, the words literally came pouring out of me. In a way that I wasn't expecting. And I realized there was a lot more to it, actually, than just writing a memoir. I tried to do a number of different things in the book, really. I tried to understand how it is that the British Police Service have come to be, I think everyone would probably agree, in a dreadful mess at the moment, and have been for quite a while. So I was trying to make sense of that. I also wanted to try and record the jobs that I did over those 30 years to try and help people understand what it's actually like to be in the police. And then there was that legacy thing, I suppose, you know, from my kids and from my family to say, right, this is what a long career in the police looked like during that period of time. And, you know, it might help them understand it a bit better, I suppose. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And then so to go like take things back to the very beginning, what made you want to become a police officer initially?
Well, I was very much wanting to avoid a sort of 9-to-5 predictable kind of office-based job. Temperamentally, I've always been a very active person. I always I'm quite an adventurous person, I suppose, in many ways. My initial intention was to join the army, to become an army officer, because I was at university in Birmingham back in the 1980s. And when it came to towards the end of my degree, like everybody else, you have to sort of start thinking about what you're going to do. And I initially applied to be an army officer. But I tell a story in the book. I won't spoil it because you've got to read the book. You've got to read the book to sort of read about the story. It's quite an amusing incident where I went for my interviews at the Army Recruitment Office in Birmingham City Centre, and I had a pretty weird experience there, which kind of put me off a career in the army. And no spoiler alerts. You'll have to read the book to read about that one. My brother joined the police several years before in London, and I was a fairly typical, I wouldn't say I was a left-wing kind of type person. I've never really been politically, you know, particularly active in any way, but I was pretty horrified when he joined the police. So I sort of had sort of swallowed that kind of myth that the police were these sort of, you know, fascist bully boys. And when I gave him a bit of a hard time when he joined the police, I said, you know, what are you thinking about joining the police? God, you know. But actually, when I started talking to him more about it, I realised that it sounded like a really, really interesting job and that they were doing a lot of really good things to help people. And so, yeah, so having failed at the first hurdle to get into the army, well, actually, I didn't fail. The army, I think, probably failed me more than I failed them. But, again, you have to read about that. I applied to join the police and, there you go. And the rest is history, really.
So when you joined the police, then this was right back in the... Oof. the 80s, the 70s?
Yeah, it would have been 19. It would have been 1988, really. Yeah, God, okay. That makes me feel pretty old. Yeah, so if you think about the context of that time, this is probably 4 years after the miners' strike, you know, which obviously was a fairly dark day for not just the miners, but also for policing, because policing didn't come out of that period very well. There was a lot of... you know, bubbling urban unrest around that time. We had I remember the Handsworth riots in Birmingham, I think was 1985, something like that. There was riots in London. So there's a lot of stuff going on at that time that, you know, brought policing, as policing always finds itself in the eye of the storm. Kind of regardless of whether it's the miners' strike or whether it's the COVID-19 pandemic, policing will always be front and centre of whatever's going on.
With that context in mind then, what was it, so how the police viewed then as opposed to how they're viewed now? Was it basically the same, or has it changed over the last 30 or so years? Or 40 years, actually? Ooh.
Yeah, well, I think that there's always been various, you know, camps, I suppose, of individuals who see the police in a different ways. I've always believed that the majority of people, reasonable people, are very strongly supportive of the police, I think. Certainly back then, I think the police broadly enjoyed, those very high levels of respect and not to say that they were perfect, they weren't perfect then, and they're certainly not perfect now. But you know, there's a little bit of a myth, and I explore that myth in my book, about the whole issue of trust in policing. That Ipsos Mori do a survey of trust in various professions, and they've done that survey every year since 1983. And policing has always come out of that with very, very high levels of trust. Usually it's generally hovering around the sort of low 70% in terms of trust. And yet other professions who routinely give the police quite a hard time, and I'm thinking of politicians and certain parts of the media when I say that, are generally way, way further down that sort of ladder in terms of levels of trust, sort of generally in the high teens, low 20s. So I think trust in policing has always been an issue, but I can remember in those days when we went out on the streets, we were we got so much respect from the law-abiding public. We really were a very reassuring presence in the street. Whereas certainly towards the end of my service, the way that police officers were being treated, generally speaking, out in the street was very confrontational. And there was a much more challenging culture. There's a much more challenging culture in society generally, I think, today, that people, particularly younger people, I suppose, don't like to be told what to do, you know. So it's all, you know, nothing stays the same, does it?
Indeed, yeah. I imagine that must be quite demoralising as well towards as you were saying, this confrontational attitude towards police people doesn't exactly make them feel like they are, I guess, like a part of the community like they used to be, perhaps.
Yeah, well, there's all sorts of things that have created that situation, Vicky. It's obviously society's changed. We have a much more questioning society now. People have got much more information upon which to base their opinions. We also have social media and the sort of ubiquity of camera phones everywhere. It's very hard for police officers now when they go out in the street, because they find themselves being filmed pretty much all the time. And often that stuff is uploaded to social media and taken very much out of context a lot of the time. It makes particularly younger, less experienced police officers very anxious about just doing the job. And I remember, even 10 years ago, maybe a little bit more than 10 years ago, I think I was an inspector at the time in Birmingham. I remember a youngish PC saying to me, we were talking about a particular issue that had happened out on the street, and I said to him something along the lines of, well, why didn't you go up and speak to them? And he said to me, well, what reason would I have to go and speak to them? And I said, excuse me, can I just remind you, you are a crown servant of Her Majesty the Queen, and you can go and speak to anyone you want, and you don't have to give a reason to talk to someone. So that really illustrated to me how things had changed, that, when I first joined, we were, we had a lot more confidence, I think, as a service. And whereas now it's I would describe it as a very fearful organization, and everybody's constantly looking over their shoulder, kind of waiting to absolutely convinced that they're going to drop in the shit at some point.
Okay.
And that's not a fantastic kind of mentality to be going out and trying to do that sort of job, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine. And then, so you were talking about changes, of course, so what for you, when you started in the late 80s, what are the biggest changes that you've seen, in the police force over the course of the last 30 years? How has policing changed?
Oh, gosh, so many.
It's immeasurably.
Just, absolutely, beyond recognition. I think one of the biggest things is probably technology. I think the sort of technology that the police use routinely for managing incidents, for gathering intelligence, for every single thing that you do now in the police has got some sort of computer system associated with it, and that comes with all sorts of headaches. as well, because very often those systems don't sort of work together particularly well. Every force in the country has its own systems that don't talk to each other particularly well. So technology is a big one. I think the demand on the organization has gone is just ridiculous compared to when I first joined. So when I first joined, we had a lot of discretion as to how we spent our time. If we felt someone was messing us around or wasting our time, we would just tell them to clear off, for, you know, putting it bluntly. We didn't tolerate time wasters. We didn't tolerate frivolous nonsense that would tie us up in all sorts of red tape. If you'd brought a trivial issue back to your sergeant in those days, he or she would have looked at you as if you were completely mad, taken the paperwork off you and ripped it up and thrown it in the bin, and just said, "Don't ever bring that rubbish back here again. Your job is to go out and support victims of crime and catch criminals. So I suggest you kind of get out and do that." Whereas today, it feels as if policing has stepped into a vacuum left by the withdrawal of so many other frontline services, particularly around mental health, drug and alcohol treatment, homelessness, all sorts of issues that now play out on the street. And because the police are the only sort of 24/7, 365 service, they end up getting drawn into dealing with a lot of stuff that's got absolutely nothing to do with crime. And in fact, they reckon that today, police officers in the UK spend less than 20% of their time dealing with anything to do with crime. And they spend somewhere between 30 and 40% of their time just dealing with issues to do with mental health. So I'd say the biggest single difference is that the demand on the organisation now is completely unsustainable and impossible to service. It's a gushing tap that never gets turned off. And because the police are trying to deal with a lot of stuff that they're not really trained or equipped to deal with, when something goes wrong now, they're kind of the ones who tend to get blamed. So I think, you know, I first joined, it was dead simple. Our job was to go out there, protect the law-abiding public from criminals, catch criminals and bring them to justice. But I mean, that's not to say that we didn't do other things as well. We did lots and lots of other things, road traffic accidents, illness in the street, you know, people dying at home and having to go and check there's no suspicious circumstances, things like that. But generally speaking, our job was to go out and deal with crime.
You talk in the book as well about this kind of, I guess, like problems within the police force, like an emphasis on that hitting targets rather than perhaps like going out and patrolling the streets, but also interestingly about a bit of a disconnect, I suppose, between the higher ups and the policemen who are actually on the street and, you know, doing their jobs. When do you feel that became a problem?
Yeah, well, I talk in the book about how things, you know, started out were really the whole idea of performance metrics or key performance indicators or things like that were just completely unheard of. We entered the Blair era, which financially was a really good time for policing. They spent a lot of money on public safety. The resources for policing had never been better. But with that came a whole raft of various performance measurements that were defined by the Home Office, which caused all sorts of problems during that period, because many of those performance indicators kind of were sort of contradictory, really. So if you hit one, you would kind of fail another. So for example, you would have one performance measurement around detecting crime. So in other words, that's kind of solving it and bringing someone to justice. And then you would have another one around reducing crime. So on one hand, you'd have a burglary that was reported. And because you'd have a target saying reduce burglary. There'd be all sorts of shenanigans going on to try and find an alternative explanation for that, you know, being something other than a burglary. And then, you know, if you couldn't kind of explain it away, I'm not saying this happened with every single burglary, it didn't, you know, obviously if it was absolutely obvious that it was a burglary, it got treated as a burglary. But if there was any doubt whatsoever that it might not be a burglary, there would almost be as much effort putting into disproving that it was a burglary than actually just recording it as a burglary and investigating it properly. And because the emphasis was on detecting crime, you would have a lot of effort put into crimes that were easy to solve or easier to solve. So if a business person, a director of a company came along and said, oh, I've just had a £20,000 fraud committed against my company or whatever, that was just in the way too difficult tray, and because you'd only get one detection out of that, whereas if somebody came along and sort of had a whole load of you know, easier crimes to solve, those would be given priority. So that whole kind of performance regime created all sorts of problems for policing and was actually counterproductive, I think, ultimately. So then you kind of moved into an era where the Tory government came in 2010 and basically said, right, we're going to get rid of all of those performance mechanisms because they're just a complete waste of time and it's all rubbish. But then they took away 20,000 officers and 23,000 police staff, and there's about 600 police stations have been closed and sold off nationally. So we experienced a completely different form of pain, I suppose, during that period. So yeah, everything's been a very strange 20 odd years for policing. And I think what the organisation desperately needs now is just a period of stability where they're just allowed to kind of get on, get you know, funded properly and allowed to get on and do the job.
So you have touched on this already, but it does sound like the police force is in a bit of trouble right now. Like, what needs to be done for it to recover properly?
Well, I tend to call it, rather than a holy trinity, I tend to think of it as a toxic triad. You've had three things which collectively conspire to have damaged policing to a point now where it's in a dreadful, dreadful mess. I don't think anybody watching the news these days or listening to some of the commentary could possibly have failed to see that. So we had a terrible, terrible 10 years or so under Theresa May as both Home Secretary and then Prime Minister. And there was what can only be really be described as a very kind of nasty, kind of almost vindictive approach taken to policing, where budgets were cut very, 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 very severely across the country. You know, as I say, we lost 20,000 officers, 23,000 police staff, and 50% of the police stations closed and sold off nationally. 75% of police stations closed or sold off in London. And simultaneously, the demand on the organisation was just going through the roof. And it's okay to say to an organisation, right, we're going to cut your budget, but to acknowledge that, we're going to say, right, here's all the things that we don't need you to do anymore because we understand that you're not going to have as many people, and it's unreasonable to expect a much smaller workforce to do the same amount of work. But when you take away all of those people, but then say, and here's a load more other things that we now want you to deal with, as well as all of the things that you've always dealt with, then that's just not going to work. It doesn't add up. We ended up with this horrible, you know, gun and knife crime epidemic. Dozens of young men dying on the streets. We, you know, at that time I was a chief inspector in the West Midlands, and then I became superintendent in the West Midlands, and I was right in the thick of it, trying to prevent a lot of that gun and knife crime. We had, you know, Birmingham had the reputation, I guess it was called, the gun crime capital of the UK. We had sort of stabbings and shootings, as you did in London. you know, on a daily basis, very often, you know, several times a day. So we were running around desperately trying to stop this with inadequate resources. Neighborhood policing teams have been completely just sort of effectively dismantled. So that's the you talk about the toxic triad, that's the politician side of it. The politicians, mm-hmm. hostile politicians causing real damage to a public sector organization. And then the other part of that triad was a very hostile media narrative, which shows no sign of kind of, you know, abating really, which I don't really understand, because I just think it's very self-defeating, actually. I think it's very self-defeating to demoralize an entire organization in that way, because believe me, the organization's terribly demoralized as a result of all of this stuff.
Mm.
They're trying to do this desperately difficult job in very chaotic circumstances, having to make very difficult decisions at sort of in real time, which will be picked and pored over for many years afterwards by teams of lawyers. And meanwhile, the media are just laughing at them. So that's the second part of it, the media stuff. And then the third part of that, which has created a really desperately unhappy service at the moment, is for a long time now, we've had a sort of a generation of, not all, because there's lots of fantastic senior officers out there, but we've got far too many senior officers who are not operationally particularly competent. They've probably been promoted above their experience. They are fixated with things that have very little to do with public safety. They're more concerned with their Twitter followers than they are with catching criminals or supporting their staff. And very often, unfortunately, when police officers do kind of find themselves in difficulties, kind of through no fault of their own, a lot of the time, just because they're caught up in something that's really messy, they very often throw really good people under the bus. So operational, the 97.5% of people in the organization who are at police constable, sergeant, and inspector ranks basically don't feel supported by their senior officers a lot of the time. So yeah, so those three things I think conspire to create a very unhappy police service.
So with that in mind then, what do you think is in store for the police in the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh God.
Only bad things.
Well, that's a question, isn't it? I mean, it remains to be seen, Vicky, doesn't it? Because the situation at the moment is that we're just lurching, the organization's lurching just from crisis to crisis. There's 5,000 vacancies for detectives nationally. Nobody wants to be a detective anymore because the job's just too stressful. The demand on detectives is absolutely horrific. The media narrative shows no sign of kind of, you know, again, just going to that one, to that point, you know, do I think the police have made some terrible mistakes? Of course I do. But my experience of police officers from a long career is that the vast majority of them are really good people, and they desperately want to do the right thing. But the reality is that they are dealing with chaos a lot of the time, and they're dealing with a lot of stuff that most people can't even conceive of. Mm. So what's the future hold in store? I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets a lot better, any better. There's this thing called Operation Uplift, which is the attempt by Boris Johnson to try and replace the 20,000 officers that Theresa May got rid of. But in reality, something like 8,500 officers have resigned early in the last 3 years alone, I believe. There are very, very high levels of resignations. There's a huge number of people who are just retiring at the normal retirement age. So in order to try and even go back to the pre-2010 numbers, they're going to have to recruit something like 55,000 police officers over 3 years. And that will result in there being, I think the numbers are something along the lines of, in 5 years' time, most police officers will have less than 5 years' service. in 3 years time, I think nearly all frontline officers will have less than 3 years service. So you've got a massive loss of experience. You're going to have the blind leading the blind on the front line. It's going to be a huge problem for sergeants and inspectors where, with this massive influx of inexperienced people into the organisation. So yeah, I think I'm sorry to say, I think things are going to get worse before they get better.
Okay, so not to end on too dire a note in that case, let's finish up by asking you, I know you go into this at the start of the book, a lot about how it annoys you, how different TV shows are to the reality of being in the police. So I thought we would end by asking you about your biggest bugbears, like how inaccurate is television really when it comes to portraying what life in the police force is like?
Oh, it makes me, I actually have to leave the room very often whenever these shows come on because it drives me crazy. Some of the ridiculous things that TV script writers seem to think that police officers do. I think the worst one, and this is the funny thing, isn't it? Because it's such a popular drama, but Line of Duty, terrible. Mm. I mean, it sort of shows this kind of dystopian police force that's just riddled from top to bottom with corruption, which inevitably leads viewers to believe that, well, you know, it must be a bit like that, but it's, of course, it's not at all. So that's why that particular program really winds police officers up. They get really annoyed with it. And I say it's a bit like creating a drama about hospital doctors and consultants where they're all a bunch of sex offenders who are all trying to get their grubby hands all over the patients every opportunity they get. You know, and that's kind of how it feels like for police officers to watch Line of Duty. But I think my absolute, the one that really winds me up when I see it, and you still see it quite regularly in dramas, is the detective is interviewing the suspect in an interview room on tape or whatever. And outside the door of the interview room, there's a uniformed PC kind of stood at attention, like not doing anything. And you just think, where do they get that idea from? That we've got so many officers that we can afford to have someone stood like a spare prick at a wedding outside an interview room doing absolutely nothing. It's like, we haven't even got enough officers to report your burglary anymore. Never mind stand around outside an interview room not doing anything. So,
well, it's something for people to look forward to when they read it. Ian, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to another White Back podcast. If you've enjoyed hearing Ian's stories of his time in the police, then why not pick up a copy of his book? It's out now and available from all good bookshops. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.